At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm not doing it. I won't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. You can't have millions of people before we get anything besides that, you know?
That's true. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Hello. Right. Welcome, Arnold. How do I say
Arnold
it?
Mint.
Mint? Mint?
Arnold Mint.
That's what I thought. I thought it was Mint, but the Y throws me off. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a Burmese name. It's like Smith in Burmese.
Oh, Jones. For real?
It's a very generic. I'm related to, like, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, just kind of, I've been a fan of Arnold's from afar. Like, you're a guy who popped onto the scene on Food TV, freaking Food Network star and Top Chef, and, you know, we're like, kind of, we're like cousins, you know? We claim a little continental vibe right there. You're a different dude, and I just super dig it. But honestly, I also know your style, you know, like Susie Wong, you know? I know that. And so I would not have been surprised if you're like, it's Mint with a Y, bitches. You know what I mean? Like,
It is. It is Mint with a Y, but, you know, it's a legit name. It's for real.
I just didn't know if it was a creative choice. Minty.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
I just said an anagram of it could be Minty. But, you know, I could take that out because who cares? This is, you know, we'll fix it in post. You know, oftentimes, Arnold, I'll say, I break the fourth wall a lot, and I'm like, oh, we'll fix it in post, and then I just leave it the way it is. Because people like the raw, unfiltered authenticity of knowing we are not, in fact, AI robot dad hosts, but we are real, flawed humans, despite what some of our listeners believe. Right, Ollie?
Yes.
One person said that. He was like, hey, dude, love the podcast. I have to ask, is Neil AI? I mean, this is how you know we're doing something. We've got a long ways to climb. We're trying to get to Everest.
It's a disclaimer. You're not AI. You're not a fabricated Stepford dad host.
I don't know. Jury's out. Ollie, can you do us the honors before we go any further?
Do a
formal introduction of today's guest so that our audience can get acquainted.
I sure
with
will.
And Arnold Mint with a Y.
Yeah, that's right. And here we go. Today's guest is a chef, storyteller, and devoted father. Arnold Mint is a native of Nashville, Tennessee, where he grew up immersed in his parents' market and restaurant. Before stepping into the kitchen professionally, Arnold was a competitive and professional figure skater, but eventually moved to New York City to attend culinary school, launching a career that has seen him compete on Top Chef, Food Network star, and earned him recognition as a James Beard semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast. Arnold's debut cookbook, Family Tie, comes out in October and celebrates the flavors and stories that have shaped his life off the clock. Arnold is a single dad to his daughter, Henley, who turns 2 this month. Early happy birthday. Arnold Mint, it is a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to World's Greatest Dad, because you are.
Hey, dads. How are you? It's good to be here.
Good, Caffeine.
Yeah, we're good.
Fitting it in between dropping off the kid, running errands, paying bills, doing all my stuff, and going back into the carpool line. That's what we're doing right now, right?
What time is drop-off and what time is pick-up?
Drop-off is at 8:10 in the morning because there's a school one block over and it's traffic jam. So we're just stuck at the other school that's 8 o'clock, you know, kind of weave through traffic, and then pickup is at 3:10.
Okay, that's tough.
Yeah, and then my life starts at 5 p.m.
What happens at 5?
I open for service.
He goes to the restaurant.
Career dad.
Right.
So really what used to happen was, you know, I'd be with my crew until 11 o'clock midnight, sit and have a nightcap till about 2 in the morning. Just one drink before, you know, and then get home. But now it's like, get me out, last ticket down. Okay, I gotta go. I gotta bounce. Get into bed before she wakes up, and start the day at 6 or 5:30 before she gets ready. Then I try to figure out what to do with my life until 10 o'clock when the rest of the world gets up and starts to function, right? I have a two-hour window to deny the fact that I need to go to the gym. And then I start my prep work, and next thing you know, I need to get to the go pick her up at carpool, drop her off, and go back for dinner service. So,
what time are you usually back home from service?
9:30.
Okay.
9:30.
And you sleep? You're in bed by 10? What's this?
I'm usually in bed, I try to get in bed by, I drink some water. I usually don't eat, but I'll be in bed and sleep by 10 these days, right?
Okay.
Luckily, she sleeps in the night, so the gods are watching over me for that.
Yeah.
That's a blessing.
So you're getting 6-7 hours. It's not nothing. I mean, you're grinding, but we're worried about your sleep health. You can't cheat on your rest. You know,
You learn that quickly. It's like, there's no extra projects when your kid's asleep. You sleep when they sleep, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm just in the phase now. You know, Ollie has a 13-year-old son named Heath. I have a 7-year-old daughter named Cece and a 5-year-old son named Zeke. And like today, they are off the grid from 8:20 in the morning till 5 p.m. And I pick them up in the same location. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
They go to their after school, which is at their school. And so, you know, we're finally turning this corner of, I'm almost like, okay, so that's, what is that, 9 hours? You know, 8.5 hours. Mm-hmm. What am I doing? Doing some podcasts, also avoiding the gym, you know, laundry, some other work I've been neglecting, you know, just,
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
I remember daycare, when we found a daycare, I think it was 12 hours. They had a 12-hour daycare. And I was living in LA at the time. And obviously this is like, you know, when the kids, our kid went to daycare starting at 3 months. My wife had to work.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in casting, which, you know, I'd have time in the morning, but I wouldn't be back. It was, you know, a 10-hour-ish day. You know, it was a 10-hour-ish day. And, we were like, we needed a 12-hour daycare just to keep up with the L.A. hustle. And a lot of that is logistics, driving, parking, all that traffic crap. You know, it's nuts. Nuts.
Yeah. That's a big reason why I left L.A. When I knew I was going to have a kid, I was like, you know what? I can barely hustle myself around town between meetings, going to, like, to see my agent or go to, you know, whatever I needed to do. I couldn't even get 3 things checked off my list in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine having a child there solo trying to figure out and navigate the world, especially with not much of a flex either. You know, like everybody knows somebody and has their foot in the door before you can even get started. So I was like starting from scratch. Like, how am I going to get this child into a program that keeps me sane and I can get back to her when I need to, you know? So Nashville was my option, just to come home.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we moved to Austin 10 years ago.
Was literally
school hustle. And it literally became a reasonable idea living in LA to be like, yeah, we'll move to Austin for a school. And there are other reasons too, but that was where the opportunity was. And 10 years later, he has been at this school from kindergarten through 8th grade, which is like, wow. And that's the beauty of World's Greatest Dad. We get to talk about, as Neil so fondly puts it, I'm a couple piano lessons ahead, but man, those piano lessons go by. They do go by, because I'm like, wait, what? Like, I remember the stroller. I couldn't believe when I had to retire the stroller or retired it as soon as we got here. I was like, I don't need this anymore. It's crazy.
Wow.
Whoops. Here we are.
That's good. That's a good thing, though. It's progress.
Yeah, something like that.
There's a
sadness to it. You know, there's a, I have this big stack of books. Where is it? I'll grab, of books like that, our kids have outgrown, and you know, we kept up too much stuff, and I'll just show you, like, this is I'm improvising this, not to take away from, you know, the interview.
This is premium podcast. The person just leaves the frame.
Like, you know, this guy, we read this a lot.
I have that.
You know that one. You know this one. you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
Brown bear. Well,
and then there's cheese.
We had brown bear. Yeah.
Brown bear.
A variation on a theme. But then you get stuff like this, which is, like, great when you have, like, a tiny one. I'm sure, you know, your daughter would love, you know, poking. You know about the...
It's all the interactive texture.
Yeah, you kind of, like, press the buttons. They make those sounds. Like, it's five. Like, he's watching Star Wars. Like, we don't need this, you know?
Yeah.
And then, but, like, this is one that hurts to lose. But, like, what am I... I don't want to become those people. Like, my wife has relatives who, like, have held on to every single thing. You know, their kids in their 30s, and they're like, here's a stuffed animal. And the kid's like, I don't care about this.
Right.
Like, this is, you guys, Daniel Tiger people, how is Daniel feeling?
Uh-huh.
It got us through a lot of, you know, hard, big feelings. But, like, again, it's over. Like, we're in big kid books now. So, yeah, I have this whole stack of stuff that I'm just, and it's hard. It's emotional for me to have to get rid of him. So,
you know, I mean, I'm a little new with this, but I did just recently clean out my parents'. It's like their, I'm going to say estate because it sounds really fancy, but they both passed away and we sold the property just because it was too big of a property to move into to take care of. And as we were going through stuff, you know, they were like the quintessential Asian family that hoarded everything, like every sour cream container, every takeout KFC styrofoam box is underneath the stairs. So, and going through all of this stuff, you know, luckily she kept everything that was sentimental in our upbringing as well. So I still have the old Mickey Mouse piggy bank that's completely like toxic, right? The one that's like super plastic. I found some old children's books that I don't even know what they are, but they're just random ones that seem, I mean, they're very old at this point, but you know, at least I kept a couple of those before we got rid of everything. This is keepsakes to kind of archive in a small box of my own that I'll pass on. But yeah, I think holding on to some's okay as long as you have some restraint, you know, just pick a few. It'll mean something. So it's good to keep. I like that.
Don't you worry. There is a stack of books that they have outgrown that I am not getting. These are just the ones we're getting rid of.
Oh, okay.
The other ones are like very sentimental. And even these. I mean, it's anyway. Walk us back, lest we get too far away from the platform we want to walk
about
here,
Neil's
which is
book fetish collection.
My hoarding tendency. It's yeah. So Arnold, take us back to, because, you know, I think it probably informs how we got here. Your childhood and what it was like with your parents and, you know, your dad specifically, and like what made you, you know, want to become a dad.
Yeah. So, wow. Okay. Let's go back. So my dad was a professor, in Tennessee teaching at university, and my mom, really came to America, I guess, just because everybody's dream is to come to America. I guess, you know, when you're of a Thai family of nine and you seem to do better for yourself and you have opportunity, and opportunity was here. So she came via Los Angeles. She worked as a cashier at a very high-end boutique hotel because she was quite the looker. She was very stylish. They put her, you know, they were like, you're going to put you front and center. And then she found her way to Nashville where her best friend was taking some classes from my father at one of the universities. My mom came to get, you know, her master's or get for education as well, but she was working as a nanny, as an au pair for this doctor's family that sponsored her to come to Nashville. And their last name was Arnold, the Arnold family. So I was named after my mom's gynecologist. Great. Awesome. That's another story in itself. But that, she worked at the doctor's office to kind of get some money and met my dad and started dating. And she gave him an ultimatum and was like, hey, I'm going to finish school and move back to Thailand. I'm the best thing that's ever going to happen to you. You need to marry me. We'll have a great life. And then, you know, my mom kind of ran the show in that way. As you know, she still does to this day, even though she's not with us. And so they opened a side gig, which was a market and restaurant, to basically satiate their cravings and their miss for home. They were homesick food wise. So they had this market. I had some family in New York. My dad, you know, he went to school in Rensselaer at upstate New York at RPI. So he had a lot of connections with people up there. We had family in Chicago. So they would travel to the larger cities to bring stuff down, you know, but when they bought stuff, they bought in bulk. And she's like, I can't just cook for myself. I'm going to open a market to sell this stuff. That way we can like eat for free, basically. And so shortly after I came along into the world, and I was raised within the walls of the restaurant, like literally, like, you know, this sounds gross, but I took baths in the triple sink in the back of kitchen, you know, back in the day. The aunties raised me. I made forts. I ran around the restaurant, the store, just as, and you know, it's like, well, you know, it's a good restaurant when the kid's the cashier kind of thing. Like, so you know that our family had a really good restaurant because that's where I learned my math, was making change through quarters and dollars and counting the, you know, I had a little shed that sold candy to the customers that they would buy for me to be able to learn how to do business at a young age. Tax-free, of course. I didn't claim that, but but you know, that was kind of my upbringing. I grew up running around in the restaurant. Like, all of my birthday parties were there, and my life revolved around the smell of a deep fryer and Asian food. So it was pretty cool, actually. And look at me now. Here I am sitting at, you know, working at our restaurant that turned 50 this year, still continuing what my parents paved for me. Actually, you know, I went full circle. I kind of ran away from home, not wanting to cook Asian food, embarrassed about it, going to culinary school, teaching French culinary, working, opening a French bistro, all this stuff, only to be back making the same dishes that my mom made 50 years ago. Hmm. So that was what shaped me in who I am. As a father, I had always wanted to be a dad. Like, I never thought of myself, like, you know, with a book of a wedding book or being a husband of, I always saw myself as being a dad. I had a really cool dad. I had a really cool mom. You know, I was very flamboyant as a child. Anything that was on a Christmas tree ended up being stapled onto a Sunday vest or blazer. And I turned it into this like skating outfit, like total flamboyant kid, right, with garland and doing shows for the customers and very vaudeville. I mean, they didn't know they had a dinner theater until I came along. They didn't have even planned on that. But I was very much a showman. And then luckily I discovered ice skating and I could put rhinestones on and be athletic, but still be who I was. And I thank my parents for helping just kind of mold that, you know, like they never limited me in who I was. I went to Cub Scouts, but I also had Barbie dolls, you know, I had a skateboard that I'd be boarding with my buddies in the back alley of our neighborhood with my Barbie doll, like on my shoulder with her hair flowing in the wind as I kept going down the alley. So it was, there was no control as to where my path was going to be as a human through them. You know, they were just like, just enjoy your life. You're harming nobody. And I thought that was pretty cool. And I feel like I wanted to continue that kind of nurturing attribute as a parent. And I've always wanted to be a parent. I've always wanted to be a dad. So luckily I am one now. It took a while. It was a very strange path to get here, but I'm glad I've gotten here.
And what was that path? How did we get here?
Yeah. So, you know, summer vacations, back in the day, we'd go back to Thailand almost every summer. And a big thing in our culture, is to kind of, it's called tambun, or do blessings or offerings, whether, you know, it's kind of like you do it when you're happy, you do it when you're sad, you do it when you're celebrating, you do it when you're mourning. And so we do a lot of support to orphanages in Asia, and our family has helped build, you know, walls for orphanages, no matter what denomination of religion you are. I think this one point, a turning point for me, I was a teenager, and like a Christian Sisters of Charity kind of thing had an orphanage for children that had HIV and AIDS. And it was really crazy to see, because those walls really, the kids that I played with and could hang out with, they were either left at the hospital, or they were, for whatever reason, that was their whole life. Their life were going to be within the school, within this complex. And at that point, I was like, gosh, I wish I could take some of these children and when I'm older and nurture them. So really my path was, let me do adoption. You know, let me work and see what other orphanages we work with in Thailand to see how could there be opportunity for someone, for me to be able to father and share some of the blessings that I've been given in my life with these children. So as a young adult, I was researching how to adopt. Being from Tennessee, the roadblocks are many, especially being single, gay, in the South, in a Bible Belt where a lot of these agencies are funded and supported through Christian organizations or religious groups. Even though I check off more boxes than I think many people that do adopt can. There's one roadblock for me at the end where it's like, you know, you're a perfect candidate except for one or two things. And I'm like, okay, I got it. You know, every roadblock is that. And then also, ironically, in Thailand, adopting out to an American citizen that's single and gay and then male is not an option, even though I have Thai dual citizenship as well. It was an interesting path just because of what tourism has done with children and trafficking and things like that. So another stigma of ours that I had to, I was like, if only you could meet me. I'm none of those, right? But I could definitely provide a great life to someone that needs it. That would also help me in my life as well. So these were all these crazy roadblocks. And then do I want to do the fostering route, right? The fostering route is hard because you're just always forewarned about, like, you know, these kids are coming from places of trauma. And am I trained as a single person enough to be able to support that in my personal pursuits and career as well? Like, am I ready? Should I, you know, I'm not going to send this child back once they're in my life. And I don't want that option. I would want them as a guaranteed 100% commitment on my end. Mm-hmm. So all of these things have been going through my head. And then COVID happened. And during COVID, a lot of my friends were getting pregnant. You know, and I'm like asking them why, you know, and that's like, I mean, I'm not saying like, you know, we were bored, we had kids. I'm saying like lesbian couples and gay couples doing this. And they're like, well, we had a chance to sit back and, think about what our future was going to be. And if we had this window of opportunity to sit and think about it now, we don't want it to be too late. We don't want to be in a geriatric ward chasing our newborn around, you know? So, and my dad was my sister is younger and my dad was older when he had her. She wasn't an accident, but I don't think she was planned. You know, I was like, Dad, you're pretty strong to have a kid at this age, but you know, congrats. That means I've got good genes too, hopefully. But, so she came, you know, at grandparents' day, all of the grandparents were the same age as my sister's dad. Right. Like, so, I was thinking about that. And even though we're in a different scope of chronological age isms these days, you know, like we can actually, we're healthier. We have a better way of caring for ourselves. I'm still an older father to my child now. And I just didn't want to be at a place where I have a newborn at 60 or whatever. And what am I going to do? How much of a life am I going to have with her till she has to heal with the loss of me? Right. So, I took that into consideration. One of my friends were having kids as well. And so I decided, you know, they did it through IVF and I started asking questions and I'm like, okay, well, nobody's going to say no when it's actually my DNA, right? That's a thing. I was already in LA partially because of my career path where it was going and also because Los Angeles was a bit more open to people similar to my situation to helping support that. I was working with, you know, a lot of centers and stuff that really supported LGBTQ+, you know, communities just to get some advice as to what to do. And the advice definitely was, hey, we can try to get you through adoption through in California as well. But, you know, it's a hard, if you've ever researched it, it's so intimidating. It's so daunting that I will age out. My time limit for that would also get me to the point where I'm, okay, I'm going to be 60 and have this child as well. And so the donor and IVF surrogacy route was what just made sense. You know, so I did that through San Diego. I found a clinic that basically supported many people similar to my situation, and that's where I am now. So, and that's how Henley came about.
What's the age difference between you and your younger sister?
I think about 8 to 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
she just hit her 40. She was a 40 under 40 recently for something. So, yeah, I think 10. I'll say 10.
Are you knocking on 50 like Ollie?
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm closing to 50. I'm headed to 50.
Holy crap! I thought you were like 10 years younger than me. Damn, this is great.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, and he's not just saying that. We don't blow smoke. You know, we keep it real on World's Greatest Dad. That's really interesting. I want to go back. I have so many follow up questions.
Yeah.
You're gonna be like, why do you care about this? Was your father? Did he continue to teach and manage the restaurant, or was that more of your mom's purview? Did he leave university? How did that
all... No. So luckily, because of my dad's income, we could support the restaurant business, right? So he used his money from teaching he's a mathematician, so he bought a ton of real estate back in the day. And then the restaurant was my mom's gig. basically when they got married, she's like, he had a vision. She's like, oh, I mean, my family had a market in Thailand. I can definitely turn this into fruition for you. And so she basically was the matriarch and the leader, the patron of the international market. She was the one. She's the namesake. Everybody knows my mother as Patty at International Market. She's the legend. So he still worked.
Yeah, he would kind of moonlight there when he was available.
Never. I mean, I don't think he ever. I mean, he let her do it because she was such a workhorse. And it was kind of a blessing for me because the time that I got with my dad was during my school schedule, right? So in the morning, my dad would wake me up, get me ready, cook me breakfast. And a lot of my time stamp and food memories is my dad cooking for me because we were on the same schedule. So, I mean, he was a phenomenal cook. Phenomenal. So, we would have that morning time together, right? And then we would have the afternoon together, and my mother and I would be, we would have the morning together, my mother would pick me up from school, and I would be at the restaurant till my dad got back from his classes and take me home. So, like, I got a good balance of both mom and dad through the experience. But my mom was more of the workhorse. I mean, she worked 7 days a week, like, nonstop.
Wow. And she loved it, it sounds like.
Loved it, and the community loved it. And that was kind of the expectation was, like, you know, she is the face and she loved being the face, and so she committed to it for sure.
Yeah. I want to go back to, because this is, you know, important stuff to just understanding your journey and for our, you know, we're 30 plus episodes deep, but you are our first single dad and our first dad from the LGBTQ community. So, and that's probably on us, but we hope to have more. But since you're here, you know, I think it's, you know, we say that this podcast is about like the expansiveness of fatherhood, how, you know, everybody does it a little bit differently. You know, experience is exactly the same. And yet, you know, if you're doing it right, we all have that same goal, which is just like, be the best, be great at it, you know, don't mess up too badly. And so I'm curious, you know, you kind of spoke to the challenges, frankly, the discriminatory roadblocks involved, you know, for someone who identifies as queer to adopt or just have children or just exist in our society in general. And yet you mentioned that you came from such kind of an open, accepting home. I mean, how did that inform your identity coming up in the colony world, coming up as just a person, an American, and then how do you kind of factor that all into being a dad now? Like, what do you teach your daughter, or what do you hope to teach her about, you know, identity and maybe acceptance?
Yeah, I mean, this is a conversation that always comes up in whenever I talk any podcast with or any interviews with my vocation, right? I was very privileged and very, very fortunate that I came from a family of intellectuals. You know, the people that we were surrounded by in Nashville back in the day wasn't the Nashville that it is now, but the people that I was surrounded by were scholars. And so they were worldly, they were musicians, they were funky, they were artists, they were eccentrics. You know, my mother loved her gay community. And like, you know, my dad was somewhat of a hippie. So they were all very, just very cool folks to be around. So I wasn't in a place that I felt very suppressed or oppressed, I guess, with the word. You know, I wasn't put in a place where I wasn't allowed to flourish. And I'm grateful for that, you know? And I think all I can say, I'm not the kind of person to picket or riot or try to sell you my car. You know, like, I'm not shoving my life down your throat per se. I'm just living by example. And that's kind of how my parents did. And that's kind of the magnet that they were to draw people like of like mind to them. Just by being very open and transparent and inclusive. And they had no judgment to anybody. Doing something to help contribute to community and to uplift their surroundings. So that's the example that I try to lead by. Mind you, the bubble of that I live in Tennessee is the only blue bubble of the state where everybody in my neighborhood thinks the same way. So, you know, and so I guess there wasn't much of an adversity for me personally. And I think that is really kind of what sparked me in my approach and being in wanting to be a father. And I can't really, what did I see? I mean, as of with what's going on in the world today about these, you know, controversial go to university or not, what these politicians are saying. I don't want to go into this, but like we're taught how to think, not what to think, right? So my parents are teaching, they taught me how to be, not what to be. And I think that's kind of what I want to follow, what the path I want to follow with my child, basically, you know, allow her to be exposed to whatever it is she's in, what sparks her interest, and to nurture that and not force her. I mean, even from a performance background, people are like, is your daughter going to skate? Is your daughter going to go into theater? And of course I would love it, because quote me on this, should she do that, every ribbon is going to be completely pressed and perfect. Every outfit is going to be hand-stitched rhinestone with the best crystals in the world. I will have the snacks. I will stage mom that if I need to, but I want her to tell me to do that, because I've also seen too many of my colleagues in the day not choose that path and be stuck in that journey, you know, and it's too late to turn around kind of thing. So I want to be that person where it's like, I want to give you the tools to flourish. I was fortunate enough to have that opportunity, and I've worked really hard to share that opportunity for you, but I can't tell you what that opportunity is going to be, right? I take that in my approach with business and in how I run my restaurant and my team there as well, but really it's just been practice. It's been practice to being a father to my daughter. So
how far did you get in professional figure skating?
So I went to nationals 4 times. I ranked nationally. I medaled, many times, pretty good. An injury kind of got me to step back. Growing up into my early teens and, well, early teens, to my early 20s during that time, and learning the alternative life of partying got exciting to me and rebelling a little bit. So training got substituted. Ice time became bar time, you know? So I ended up, you know, living that life a little bit and going a little hard. And then I started touring, professional skating and touring, which kind of gave me that performance outlet that I missed so much. And that afforded me to travel the world and see the world. I worked with some really great companies, in principal positions. So like I was kind of at center, front and center, kind of starring and stuff as well. So that was nice. Yeah.
That's a big deal. The
nationals. It was good. It was a good time.
My wife was a figure skater through all the way through high school.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is to say now when we go with our kids, she can, you know, do a couple moves and it's very impressive and that's it. That's all she has to show for it. She had an offer, I think, to be on Disney on Ice.
Yeah.
After high school. And instead her mother forced her to go to college.
Yeah.
And I believe the quote was, she said, I'm not allowing you to delay college to go be a teacup in, you know, Memphis or whatever. Yeah.
You know what? I was a kid in a mullet and a red Bob Mackie diaper all through Europe. And I did the Disney path as well. And I was the one face character amongst a bunch of jungle creatures. And that was kind of like, you know, I got to lip sync to my favorite songs in every language around the world. So that was a kind of a great experience. I jumped on cruise ships and, you know, would fall down because the ship would be listing, and it'd be a funny experience for me there. But I wouldn't change that for a lifetime. For anything, it's a different kind of college. You know, it's a different, you see the world, you work with people, the path of it was worth it for me. So I wouldn't have changed that at all.
And your parents were supportive of, unlike Neil's mother-in-law, your parents were supportive of this endeavor?
They didn't understand why I would train 8 hours a day during school, and how, like, my senior year in school, I was basically a truant, and I only went to class, like, 60 days out of the year. But luckily the curriculum they put in, because I was training so hard at the time, we just won Junior Olympics or something. It was like, I was like really training into the point of like sponsorships and going into the envelopes. The Thai embassy gave me a passport just in case US didn't work. I could go for Thailand. Like that's the place I was at. So, luckily the school system put in like my physical education, all my electives were skating. and then I could just take my preliminary, you know, my basic classes in school, and got me through. But they didn't understand at all. It was many teary nights. My coach was the one that escorted me to competitions, just because she believed in me. And every year she would come to my parents and be like, we need X amount of money. If you can get it for us, Arnold needs to keep training. He's got this path. You know, sponsorships started coming in. My dad went to one nationals once, and like, it was pretty exciting. But every time they showed up at the rink, I would fall apart because I was like trying to prove myself too hard. But in hindsight, I feel that it was almost a tough love situation. I was really nervous and I would fall apart, but I think it was in part, look, in hindsight, I saw so many potential skaters who were living their parents' dream. All the moms were in the audience watching in the stands like all day long. And for me, I was probably one of the ones that was really, really excelling in training every day. And I had nobody to cheer me on other than my coaches. But I was the first one on the ice and the last one. You had to kick me off every single day. I loved it so much. That it's interesting that I knew I loved it because of my personal passion for it. And I appreciate now that my parents weren't there. You know, at one time I was like, why can't you be like all the other parents? But now I'm like, I'm glad you weren't, because I pushed myself. Like, nobody taught this to me but myself. But inadvertently, they paid the bills, so it was because of them, you know? So
I'm so curious, because there are a lot of things that I feel like similar. You grew up in Nashville, grew up in St. Louis. My parents are immigrants from, you know, albeit a much more impoverished, smaller country in Asia, Bangladesh. But I never came close to getting on the ice. How did you learn how to freaking ice skate in Nashville? How?
I went to a birthday party, and for whatever reason, I loved ice skating. I watched it all the time, and my dad would record these national championships on VHS for me, and I watched them. Like, I guess I would assimilate this to guys watching play-by-plays of football games over and over. I don't know. Like, I'm assuming that's what happens in the other scope of the world that I don't partake in. There's sports out there that people love and pay a lot of money for. And I guess people love watching and rewatching games. I would rewatch Nationals over and over and over, to the point that I would start to mimic it on ground. And I basically went to a birthday party to skate for the first time and did what they call an axel, which is 1.5 rotations. You kind of learn that as your seventh element jump of the seven that you go through. Is there seven? Maybe six. I don't remember. But I did it as soon as I stepped on the ice. And this coach was there, like, it was a public session, birthday party. And she's like, do you skate? And I'm like, this is actually like my second time on the ice. And she's like, well, that's pretty awesome. Do you want to try to skate? And I'm like, okay. And I took a lesson, and then it kind of disevolved from that. You know, but I learned it by watching, like literally by watching and faking it just to play.
You're and then it just kind of
then,
you're
then I had to relearn it. I had to relearn phenom. Technique, you know, to make sure it wasn't an accident. But it was just one of those things. That's like, I just was drawn to it. I don't know.
So when did cooking take over ice skating?
Yeah. So I was I did the Disney thing. I did cruise ship thing. I did theme park skating. I did professional shows and whatnot. I went to New York. I skated for a dance troupe called the Ice Theater of New York. I was taking dance classes. When I was on the ship, I fell in love with musical theater. So I went to New York to do that route, to be like, I don't want to be on skates anymore, but I still want to perform. And like many people pursuing that in New York, you're working in restaurants. So I was working in restaurants, and I was like, you know, the front's great and all, but like, I kept hanging out with the boys in the kitchen just because I was raised in a kitchen, you know, and I'd go out and drink beers with them after and whatever. And so I had to figure out a way to stay in New York. My dad was a scholar. He's like, if you have education, here we go. Now we're going to connect. Me and your wife, Neil, are going to connect in this way. If you have education, I will support your education, but no more of this dance class voice lesson thing we're going to pay for. So I'm like, okay, there's a loophole in this. Culinary school is considered an education, that you have to have tuition and you have to have housing. Guess what? I'm going to culinary school, but I'm not going to go to CIA. I'm going to go to the one in the city so I can still go to the bars with my buddies after we go to auditions and coast through culinary school. And when I went, and then I started going to culinary school that way, and then I just fell in love with culinary school. It was like, oh my gosh, this is my language. These are my people. It made too much sense for me. I was finally excelling in school. It was something that I was, you know, just doing really well at. And then also at the time, I was doing scholarship competitions with different recipes and vendors, you know, and I got like scholarship money by competing these recipes. And I'm like, oh, it's just like skating, but it's cooking. Like, make something pretty, but it has to be technical on the plate, and then like present it and you're going to win some money. I was like, oh, I know how to do this. I've done this since I was 13. So I kind of fell into this world of cooking and still making it a show. And I just kind of took that path. Yeah.
You obviously had quite a journey before you were able to, you know, become a dad. And, you know, yeah. Based on that journey, you had, you know, you had a time frame of like, okay, we are 30 days out. We are 6 days out. We are T minus 12 hours. What did you do to prepare? Especially, you know, being on your own, you know what I mean? Like,
I think this is the meat of where I wanted to get to. I was hoping we would get to this part because I think this is very insightful for potentially anybody that's a single parent that has an opportunity to plan being a single parent, right? Like I said, I was trying to adopt and I was hitting roadblocks because I didn't have a partner to do it with me. Had I had that in my life, I think we would have just, I'd have a family, a full house right now running around, but that part wasn't in my path, right? And I wasn't going to sacrifice my personal goals and identity just to have a child with a partner. Like I said before, I always saw myself as being a dad, really not as a husband. So in planning this, one, let's just rewind a little bit before that T-minus, you know, I had to do my research as to how much it was going to cost financially. It's a huge burden. I should not say burden. It's a huge privilege to have the opportunity to invest this way. But I had to make sure that I had that settled and I knew what to get ready for. And I had the proper counseling to make sure that I could pull this off, you know, like, and it got to a point where it's frustrating. You get a letter from your clinic and you're like, yeah, everything was so good. Your surrogate's so great. And then 2 seconds later, you're at the grocery store and you get a bill for $45,000 to cover that trip that she went to make sure it was great. And then you don't know what these bills are anymore because next thing you know, it's $120,000 by the end of the week. And you're like, okay. And you're paying her lawyer fees, her daily per diem. She's got children of her own. My donor's in Miami. My donors are in Oregon. My surrogate's in San Diego. All of their lawyer fees are involved. I'm flying them, getting them cars. They're on a retainer. It took about 2.5 years to finally have Henley. We went through two rounds that didn't take. So all of a sudden, financially, you're like, okay, I can't say no. I did read the fine print. I did have an attorney, but like it was a lot. It's still like, remind me again why I'm hemorrhaging all this money today, you know, that kind of thing. So just to make sure that like I had that, all of that and the credit cards open enough and kind enough to help me out was the first hurdle, right? Just to get through that. And mind you guys, this is the best advice I got from one of the ladies at the clinic was like, get a credit card that has a really great, great limit. Because that gives you miles. Because to this day, I'm still flying on my kid's birth. I have a lot of bonus and perks because of Henley. So that's kind of like, you know, I get upgraded because of her coming into the world. But so that's one. Then to prepare for it, I looked at it this way. And it may be non-traditional. I didn't obsess and go to parenting classes. I didn't read too many books. Obviously, as soon as you are pregnant for the first time, you're going to get advice from every single person that's had a child because everybody that's been through it is an expert in their own way, right? And they want to help you and you're just like, it starts to become like almost over too much. Like you're like, okay, I need this, I need this, I need this. And maybe you listen to the first two people and then all of a sudden you're like overloaded with all this stuff in your house, things that I have never even used. You know, I'm like, okay, this was way, I bought too many designer things to start that she never even got to wear. Like, okay, you know, you got to scale this down. Maybe I framed one, but the rest of it never got touched. So I did that kind of, I was like, I know I'm going to get advice. I know I have people in my life that have children that are going to help me. I had to make sure I planned properly with being in San Diego before her birth. I had signed up for parenting classes a month before, and I was going to stay the whole season of Henley's. Basically, I rented for the season a house in San Diego. And I planned to be there to take whatever the hospital and my clinic and the surrogacy office was all helping me with. And I thought that was going to be enough. So basically, she was due in October, or set to be due in October, and I got a call in September. So all of my plans came a month early. No house yet. No school yet. None of the people I signed on to help me in nannies and nurses yet. So I literally got a call. I was working on the line, and they're like, you need to come to California like tomorrow. And I'm like, okay. So I booked a flight that night. I texted my assistant, my sister, and I'm like, Anna, can you be there? Whatever. My assistant's like, I can't be there because my son's got something, but I'll be there 2 weeks later. So I immediately went on care.com and found some nanny that moved in with me in a temporary rental. That wasn't the house that I was renting for the season, to go shopping for all of the stuff that I had ordered to be delivered to the house to build in San Diego. I had to get a new set to get there 3 weeks early. So I land with this nanny, no child yet, building all the stuff I needed to get ready, had to take zero classes. And I'm like, you're going to be doing this. I'm just going to shadow you when she comes out. That's what's going to happen. And so luckily my sister and my assistant came in the day before Henley was born. I was already living with Yvette, who was the nanny I met on care.com with no child yet. And she's giving me a crash course of like, yes, you're good. You've got the tools. You've got the kits. You've got your starter kit. We're good to go. Knowing that we're going to move in 2 weeks into the main house for the season to start my parenting classes after. So basically, once Henley was born, I basically had hired two other nannies and nurses to help me with this. And I had a 24/7 rotation of people while I was still learning, like in real life with the child already present. So that's kind of how I jumped into this. So I didn't really take any classes because I couldn't. Cause she was like, I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
I think you might qualify to write a book on everything you just described. I mean, shit, I'd watch it on Netflix because it's such like a unique, talk about Modern Family, right, Neil?
Yeah.
Modern Family. That is some Modern Family stuff right there.
I'm curious, does any, I know you have the cookbook coming out, does any of this, how much of your, you know, journey to becoming a father, if any of it, and being a dad and then your childhood, is there kind of personal weaved in, or is it kind of like just the facts, just the recipes?
Oh, no, this book, it's called Family Tie for a reason. I mean, there's so many layers. I feel that I'm so proud about this book because if you took the recipes away, it'd still be a beautiful memoir of food and growing up in the South with my mother's influences. If you took the stories away, it's still a beautiful photo book. I mean, Linda Zhao is an amazing cookbook photographer. Her accolades are, I mean, her credits are crazy. But literally how this all started was as a tribute to my mother, who was pregnant with my sister, and that's the foreword of the book. She was pregnant with my sister in the 80s and had a little spiral notebook making her own first little self-published cookbook with little scotch tape and cartoons, taping it on and typing all these recipes. And she would give it out to all of her friends and she sold it at the restaurant, but it was in broken English, no chef terms, not standardized recipes. I transcribed those and added them into this book. All of those recipes start with the word mom in them. And it's a tribute to her life, her story, with what she did for me in my life and my story in the same walls that I grew up in. So definitely it is to honor my family legacy, but also to give my sister, give my daughter kind of her recipe box of archive heirloom recipes and stories to remember because she never met them, right? So hopefully she will have met them through this book. My daughter's in it very little, one photo of her, but my mother's in it all over from first page to the end. So yeah, it's in there. There's a lot of stories. It's very telling.
Was that part of the... I mean, I know you always wanted to be a dad, but was that part of the, impetus to do it now was, you know, like the fact that your parents, you wanted to kind of continue their legacy. They're not here anymore.
Yeah. I mean, to keep it short, I know I tend to ramble a lot, but to keep it short. Yeah. I'm the oldest Mint, right? I take that back. My dad was married before, and I have some cousins that are probably the same age as my sister. I have an older half-brother, but he's no longer with us as well. So in terms of the lineage, I'm, like, between my mother and my father, I'm the oldest. And I feel just, you know, my sister's kind of in an independent woman kind of path right now. Like, she's living her best life with all of her girlfriends. And it's like, this is my parents' first grandchild. Maybe the only, you know? So the legacy has to live on. But I will also say, ironically, and in a very bittersweet, beautiful, poetic way, it wouldn't have happened had they not passed away, if that makes any sense. With all of the things that I described, being a gypsy ice skating with a red, you know, with a red diaper on, can't afford this. So luckily they gave me a gift to be able to support this journey as well.
Yeah. So. If you're comfortable sharing, and by all means you don't have to, but I mean, the expenses you were describing, did you ever calculate the all-in cost of the journey? What it took?
Yeah, so, you know, there's different paths you can take to this. I obviously am somebody that's a little extra, and I was raised to be like, if you're going to do something, do it full force and have the best. My dad was like, don't drink a Diet Coke, have a real fucking Coke. You know, like, just like, if you want chocolate, let's go to Belgium. You know, let's experience it. If you can do, right? Like, you owe yourself the experience to have a reference point of the best of the best, and that's why I'm on this show. But so for me, you know, there were definitely, when you are, I guess, I don't want to say shopping, but I guess you are doing your homework and your research. There, you reach out to this clinic, they answer the phone, and you're like, hi, my name's Arnold, I would love to become a father. Okay, can you send your financials over? Is it worth the time to talk, right? Because let's cut to the chase. It's a high-dollar business in that sense. And I'm like, okay, sure, here are my financials. I already had it from trying to adopt. I already had the paperwork, so you can see that I'm serious about it. And for whatever reason, the tone in my voice, they took me seriously and right away jumped right in. They're like, okay, let's do this. And I was shocked in that. I think I could hear it. Like, maybe just a certain kind of, like, you know, filter. Like, okay, this dude's not just calling, you know, like, randomly. He really wants to do this. So then they connected me to these attorneys. The attorneys explained to you the fees for the attorneys. Then they're like, we can go through agencies. Agencies for the donor, agencies for the surrogates, right? We have a roster of surrogates on our own, but all these other agencies have, like, different tiers, different prices. There are people that I've considered that were students just trying to pay off their loans, younger. I basically got what we regarded to as the Bentley of surrogates. She had 9 in her history. I was her last. She had 2 children of her own throughout this. She was like a baby machine, amazing success rate. Her husband was very supportive. They know how to make it happen. Superstar. People on, like, literally, I think when I went to my psych analysis, my psychologist came back off the record and told me that him and his partner or his husband were trying to have a child and really wanted my surrogate as well, but I got her first kind of thing, you know? So she was in high demand. So that alone comes with a price point. You can go from anywhere from, like, you know, 20,000, 30,000 to keep doing the math to higher. And then you go into donors, and the donors, basically, they have rates of, if they're first-time donors or success rate donors, from thousands of dollars to $20,000, $80,000, $100,000 of dollars based on that rate. Now, I will tell you this. I went through 3 donors. My first donor, I went through the clinic, and she was new. She, lesbian, firefighter, roller derby, 5'10", you know, all of the things. Like, basically, it's like, you know, it's almost like a dating app. You can swipe left, swipe right. You can curate your own child. And I really didn't care. I just wanted a fit that was going to be like, yeah, we're going to have a kid. Yeah, that's great. So her eggs weren't as successful. She wasn't that expensive. Very reasonable. She had come from a family that had done this a lot. I think her mother was also somebody that worked within the clinic. And, you know, they were a very cool, progressive California family. Her wife ended up donating eggs as well, 21-year-old, 22-year-old, and I got a ton from her, but they kind of gave me a BOGO with that situation because they just really wanted this to happen for me. But then to double down, we found another donor who had just given 1 million eggs to somebody, and she was out of Miami, Columbia grad, Dominican, Black, beautiful person, works in high, she audits fine living, fine dining, resort hotel, very similar kind of aesthetic and likes and everything, and educational background with our parents. And so, like, I had her. So I had totally three opportunities here that we combined. In terms of finding the surrogate, I got her. Luckily, she was in San Diego. A big part of the negotiation was that her husband worked for the state, so the hospital paid for all of the state paid for all of her medical expenses. You know, so that kind of helped also. Ironically, after my child was born, her husband retired. So, like, it was kind of like they were kind of holding off to help support me have this child as well. So the village was massive, if you can think about it, right, in getting this to happen. But to answer your question, it was probably close to $300,000. $300,000, $350,000. And that's being humble. I'm ignoring a lot of the other expenses.
Okay.
You know, that doesn't include the house rental in La Jolla. That doesn't include
the full-time it's helpful to know. Look, I think these are some of the things that, you know, it's almost like salary transparency. You know, a lot of people, it's taboo or seen as gauche to ask or discuss. But I think it's important to acknowledge that this type of way of becoming a parent is often a financial obstacle for many people.
It's an obstacle, and I hate that it is, right? It's really hard because I don't want to be the exception in the situation, but what I realized was I was very much the norm of every single person that's been through this process in this clinic within these walls. And you can do it independently and do it your own way, but the roadblocks that I tried to do initially with a friend that was going to be a surrogate that ended up getting in a relationship, getting pregnant on her own, and then couldn't do it, I had already invested 7 months in that. And then she ghosted me, and I was like, you know what? I mentally can't handle that either, right? So this was my guarantee. I also didn't have somebody to hold my hand and stay up all night in bed reading and doing our homework on our own. I needed to trust a team that was accountable also, right? So this is the path for me. And I wanted the Bentley. I wanted somebody that's been through it, because had I worked with somebody that was younger, they could have just dropped out at any time. You know, I wanted the guarantee. At this point, I'm 2 years in. Like, I need, like, you know, and even now, and literally we were like, you know, the first time we did it, it didn't take. And I took about 9 months or so to kind of rest. And my agency was like, you're still paying this woman on a retainer. She needs to know if you're going to have this kid or not. She's going to retire when she's 40. She's about to be 40. She doesn't want to do this anymore. And then I was like, all right, well, let's do it. But if we're going to do it, let's get some more donors in to make sure there's an egg that's going to work. Right. So when Henley was inseminated, the other donor we put two eggs in, one from two different donors. And we basically were hoping for like two children that were going to come out looking completely different. One Dominican black, one freckled, blue eyed, blonde haired, you know, and seeing what was going to come of it. And Henley survived that round. So
science is incredible.
It's insane. So I had a Filipino American's surrogate, a Scandinavian donor inseminated with my Dominican donor with my Thai and Burmese roots all in one package.
I got to tell you, you say it's Bentley. To me, it sounds like you're pretty much set up. If we found out Earth was going to end and we have to save mankind and create a new utopian society in a space station, I think we would be going with your plan.
Right. I mean, I did just renew my egg freezing, so I have about 15 more embryos ready to go, so we could start another nation soon if we need to.
All right. Eh, you never know. You mentioned, obviously, we all know this as dads, the waterfall of advice that comes. Was curious to know what your experience was getting advice on parenting from the LGBTQ community.
For my child or for me?
Like did any other queer parents kind of offer advice from that lens, I think?
You know, I think it was very... I think the advice wasn't as much, it wasn't so queer centric or around our, you know, who we are. It was more just very being very protective and being aware of who we're putting our child's hand, like putting with our child at times, especially being single. Some of the mothers were like, you know, when you're shopping for schools and stuff like that, just what to look for and just to make sure that there's like open conversation. You know, I think, you know, I was raised in a Buddhist family, so a lot of stuff in Tennessee is very faith-based, and I have to be very cognizant of how she's being taught. Even though I was raised in a school that was predominantly Jewish, and I did go to a Catholic school, my dad wanted me to experience just other religions. So I went to Catholic school for a year just to experience that as well. I just, you know, that was being more like, you know, make sure that the train of education that she's being molded with, because I'm solo at home, you know, is something that that aligns with my beliefs. So we went Montessori route for her, you know, at this point, and knowing that this school is going to kind of segue into the prep school that my sister and I went to, which is very progressive, artsy, scholarly school, just to get her ready, her mindset ready for that. And also to look for people that, are similar to me in every environment, you know, in terms of class lists, parents lists, and things like that. So luckily there are, you know, some gay parents and single parents at the school. So, I mean, the conversation I think is yet to be had with the advice, because there's going to come a time where, like, my dad had to explain at Grandparents Day with my sister that he was actually the parent, you know, but where's mommy in all these videos? Miss Rachel talks about mama all the time, but mama's not there. I'm mama, I'm papa, I'm both, I'm all. You know, how come, like, at the first mixer, I was the only one? You know, that's going to be a bigger place where I'm going to seek advice down the road. But up to now, you know, I think common advice.
You know, when I think about, like, the different things you have, your different endeavors and how mm-hmm. far you've taken these things, you know, you strike me as a bit of an overachiever in whatever you do. Go hard or go home, right? But, you know, you're a dad now, and, you know, certainly perspective and the way we even look at ourselves, personal success in general changes. Has that changed for you? Like, have you looked at, you know, your professional ambitions and do you have a different idea of what success is now being a dad?
Well, I think the biggest success is being a dad first. It's getting your kid to bed and no drama and waking up and getting out the door. That is the biggest success of my everyday right now. I'm actually hitting milestones of success in my life that I've never really thought I could achieve on a daily basis. You know, my goals are very bucket listed. Like, one dramatic thing happens every few years, but now it's like every single day is a triumph. I feel, yes, she ate a freaking carrot. Thank goodness. Like, go Henley, go, you know, we did it. So my goals are still big and lofty. And I think part of this in my plan, I guess, is the mathematics side of my dad, right? My goals are big that don't happen overnight, but there are points of it that I can, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There's achievements like my book, like, you know, thing like having a restaurant, building a new house, that things like that are like this. I will see the end of it. I will see the rewards of that at some point. But in terms of goals, I'm very content with where I am, and I'm glad I've taken the time to get to where I am before jumping in too much. I guess it's for career as well. Things happen for a reason, and I think had any of this happened to me earlier in life, I'd be a complete mess, right? I'm still pursuing my Hollywood dreams. I mean, Ali, you understand, like, we're newer and newer, prettier, taller, better, comes along every single day, and I still want that moment to have my name on a marquee. And I'm just not going at it full force as much because I'm very content with where I am and what I'm doing now. I've had my share of successes. I will definitely gladly take more. I feel ready for more. But if time gives that to me, that's great. If not, there's not much left that I need to get done in my life. You know, it's like I was offered kind of to grow the restaurant in a large scale way, my family restaurant. And I was like, you know what, you're probably going to be shocked to hear this, but I'm going to say no. I don't need to owe you $17 million. I don't need my name in lights in that way. I have 100 customers that come in every single night that are super happy. My staff is happy. I can go pick up my kid down the street. We're making beautiful food. There's integrity in this, you know? It's like, so in my mind, that goal of like, go, 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 go. Obviously, I'm still going hard at this point because I have a book tour and things, but I'm a little bit more calm about pushing. The hustle's not as dire in my mind. The priority is now in my kid and building a place of comfort and stability that I already have and just maintaining that. So that, I think that's what I could, Neil, I guess you could say is what shifted me a little bit, just in my daily motivation. It's not like, at first I was like saying yes to everything just because it was there. Now I'm a bit more selective because I know what I have already here.
You know, something I think Neil and I both have to acknowledge with having you on is when you mentioned, oh, yes, Henley ate a carrot. We both can appreciate that win. But the thing is we also aren't alone. You know, we have partners and stuff like that. It's you're doing it all. Are there moments where you feel that weight? And how do you navigate through that?
The moments I feel that weight is when I have to pee in public. Like when I have to go to the bathroom, like at the grocery store. And I'm like, shit, man. Like literally, I'm like, oh my God, how do I, like, how, cause she'll like, even at home, like she's already in there ready to play with the toilet paper, like, and like, you know, mess with me. And I'm like, just give me a second, kid. Like, come on, you know? That's my main stress. Like I look at parents traveling cause I've been flying a lot lately with this book tour and stuff. And, I wish she could come along with me because it's going to break my heart when I leave in the fall to go on this book tour because she's not going to be around and she's going to miss me as much as I'm going to miss her. But I also can't physically figure out how to make that happen when I'm doing three things in a day in one city for one day, right? I wish she could just be there behind the camera for the morning show and I could jump onto the next gig, but it's not in the cards for me. That's a frustration that I wish I could have, you know. But on the flip side of that, I love that I have to answer to nobody and my decisions are my decisions. There's no discussion. Like whatever I have to do, I get to do. How I want to dress her, how I want to feed her, how I discipline her, how I guide her is my choice, right? And there's no back and forth. There's no contemplating. It's like, I mean, I'll think about it and do my homework. I'm not impulsive, but like I have to answer to myself. But also the accountability is all on me as well. So
that's a very, 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 very real and valid point. In fact, that's co-parenting is almost, that could be almost its own spinoff podcast. So here's one for you. How do you think Henley will describe you decades from now?
Ooh, do you ask this to everybody?
Neil's very good at this. He has these great hard-hitting questions.
This is a good question. How would she describe me?
We sometimes qualify it with like, how do you hope?
The thing
that we talk about is like, you know, when you're like in college, oh, my dad's kind of like this. Like she's having that conversation with her, you know, at a college party or she's, you know, bringing someone home for the first time. How is she describing dad?
I hope that she describes me more as her friend, as her best friend, or a mentor. Because the roles of dad at home aren't, because there's no, like, I'm not the husband, I'm not, there's no dad, there's no mom, I'm just the one that exists with her. And I think she regards me that way anyway. Like, the way she relates to me and communicates with me isn't like I'm her superior. She's not asking for permission, but we're having a conversation every single day about how to exist together. You know, it's like she's already very, she coexists with me. Like I'll be like, Henley, bring me the dish. Okay, let's do that. Like she'll do, like you dropped it, pick it up. And it's not me like telling her, pick this up. I'm like, Henley, hey, come on. And then she'll be like, okay. And then like, it's very conversational all day long with us. So I hope that rapport continues and I'm not the disciplinarian. I'm not the one she fears or the one that punishes her. Luckily, touch wood, she's not been done anything that makes me need to right now. Right. You know, she's not that sassy yet. But we're very open and communicative in the sense that she's very receptive to how I approach just her existence. And I hope that continues. You know, that she sees me as kind of like as a peer or as a colleague or as a little bit of an older brother mentor, but more so like, this is my friend that's teaching me, kind of like, this is my guide into the world. So,
aside from the carrot eating, what has been the proudest moment you've experienced so far as being a dad?
The proudest moment, food-wise or in general?
Whatever, man. Whatever it is, moment, whatever floats your boat.
Okay, so I'll give you two proud moments. Is when she farts, she says sorry. She loves, she's like, oops, sorry. And I think that's so adorable. I don't know where she picked that up from. Because at this point, I'm like, if you gotta go, you gotta go, girl. Just do it, you know? But she's like, oops. And she's very dainty about it. So probably the only dainty thing about her is, like, she apologizes when she passes gas. So she's, I like that she's communicating. She's very aware of who she is right now, and I love that. Also, food-wise, just because I'm a chef, I love that she loves food. For now. And I say that because you guys are probably, you've been through this phase. And I have a sous chef who has a five-year-old that we've been through it too. At two, he was also very adventurous. And now he's in French fry era, right? But Henley right now literally looks at a plate that, I mean, she watches me prepare dinner. We eat on proper china. No kids, no child's play at this point, you know, for dinner. And she watches me make everything. That's our moment to kind of connect. I make breakfast. I pack her lunch. And she'll get her dinner, and she'll, like, pull her plate over and be like, nice, and react to this, like, new thing every single day. And we're being very adventurous. I know she likes noodles. She loves okra. She loves fish. And so hopefully this momentum continues with just her appreciating. She doesn't, if I give it to her first, she'll taste it and kind of think about what she's tasting. But she's not denying that opportunity. She's not denying that moment. She'll take it, right? And I want, that's, hopefully I keep, she keeps that up. Hopefully she'll be like, and there's things she won't eat again, but she'll eat it for that meal. And she'll be like, no, next time I bring it out, you know, I threw broccoli in a quesadilla the other day and she knew. Like, she was like, you tried, but I'm not going to, I told you no, like a month ago, it's not going to happen, you know?
All right. I have to dip into this just because, you know, my experience certainly with Thai food is that it has, it's so dynamic. It has such range. And it can delve into some pretty strong, memorable flavors. What is the craziest, wildest, most extreme Thai flavor Henley has experienced thus far?
I've been kind of kind with her in terms of introducing Thai flavors, except for when after school, we pass the restaurant. Sometimes she'll be like, snack, and I'll like pull over and we'll go in for snack. And my cousin's there and loves to give her fruit, right? So she'll give her, like, her mangoes or her go-to. But then that'll be my lunchtime as well. So, like, it's, like, the restaurant's closed from a pocket before dinner, from lunch to dinner. So, like, that's when all the staff is kind of hanging out and doing whatever. And so I'll sit down. And the other day I made her just, like, for snacks, she had mangoes and smoked duck. Smoked duck lo mein, basically. Smoked duck bami. We just got done braising the duck and smoking it. So she was eating the duck lo mein. And that wasn't lofty. That's kind of like a neutral flavor. But I had a drunken noodle. And the drunken noodle is, you know, Thai chilies, Thai roasted garlic, Thai chilies, garlic, fish sauce, Thai basil. And she loved my dish. Like, I was like, oh my God. Like, my child is eating this, like, heat level that's kind of, you know, mid to high level, like level 7, level 8, and she put up cup in her mouth, and she stopped for a second, and she forgot about her smoked duck, and she was just, like, going to town on my noodles, and I'm like, I didn't teach you that. I don't know what's going to happen in a few hours when I have to change her diaper, but you know what? Let's see where we go with this, and she just went. She went for it. So, you know, I mean, that's cool, I guess.
That's impressive. That's impressive. Yeah. Now, yeah, I've developed a little, I've been making my own, I always call it nom prick or prick nom, but I've been making it. Yeah. And I was shocked when I had it. It wasn't one note spicy at all. No. It works. It just works itself out. And so maybe Henley will find that balance.
And she likes Indian food. She loves curries. And I'm just, I mean, you know, it's like, I think what we did was she loves okra chips, like crispy, like the Trader Joe's dried okra snacks. Like, she loves them. And so I was like, well, she loves okra. Let me give her, like, the bindi masala and see what happens here. And so she loved it. Like, she, like, just kept going to town. And so now it's like, okay, now I got you into this Indian era, which is great. She likes the naan. She likes dipping it in. She likes the dal. Like, she goes for it. So hopefully she keeps it up, because I think that it'll keep me sane, too. Like, I don't have to stare at baby food all day long. Like, you know, God forbid a chicken tender happens.
Oh, let me tell you something.
Oh, it's gonna happen.
I bought my kid Raising Cane's the other day. They somehow find it. It's out there.
Yeah.
Fast food ain't going nowhere.
But I mean, we have pizza day. We have pizza day at the school on Fridays. So I'm like, yo, we're never having pizza day at home. Like, that's your one pizza day is Friday. I mean, even though I crave pizza, I'll do it for lunch when she's away, but like, we can't have pizza day because she's already got that checked off her list every week.
It's hard to be a chef's kid, you know?
There's a lot of pressure. I mean, what book do I have over here? One second. I'm going to show you this book. I'm going to leave frame too. Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah. You know about David that one?
David Nayfield. Mm-hmm. So I listened to his podcast the other day. I think I don't know what podcast he was on, but this is inspired by Cooking for His Daughter. And he's like a Michelin chef. You should get him on. Get him on the show. He's fun. He's a fun talk.
Yeah, let's get him. It's really good. We're going to roll this clip and say, Arnold said you have to come on.
Endorsed right here. Yeah. Dad, what's for dinner?
It's really funny.
Actually, it's funny to listen to him talk because he was like, this world of like pre-made pancake mixes. And I'm like, well, what world do you live in? Oh, the Michelin world. I'm sorry. Okay. We all use
pre-made. Oh, that's really funny. Like, he didn't know about it. That's like when I heard someone talking about the other day. I think they were talking about like late seasons of one of the shows Bill Cosby did, like post-Cosby show. And there was a storyline that the writers wrote about, you know, his character has to take money from the ATM. And he said, you can't just make up a machine that spits out money. You can't just make things up. And they're like, this is like, he's never had to get cash for himself.
Right.
I have one more question for you. And then you've been so generous with your time. Will you do the dad lightning round with us?
Yeah. I mean,
all right. All right. So, we're just curious. Has Henley met, Suzy Wong?
Yes. Henley has met my alter ego, Suzy Wong. So for those of you, I mean, I have a drag alter ego. I had a drag themed kind of centric restaurant. The brand is still out there. It's very much like a Ronald McDonald kind of facade, but Asian. Suzy Wong is my alter ego. She's very chic and everything. And I do a lot of, Henley's met parts of Suzy Wong in the sense that she's met me in half face or in makeup or whatever, leaving or coming back or doing some kind of a reel or collaboration. Recently, 2 weeks ago, I was in Chicago at Miss Continental, a pageant, and I had some videos that I did promoting a coffee house and some things as well. And my daughter was watching them, and the nanny was like, who's that? And she's like, that's dad. We were like, well, what? And she was like, that's Papa. And I'm like, oh, she saw right through it. So apparently I'm not very good as a drag queen then, I guess, if my daughter can see through my makeup. No, it was just really cool.
She just knows you so well.
She just knows me. Yeah. She was listening to it and I was doing this kind of, you know, commercial endorsement thing. And she was like, that's Poppy.
That's very cute.
Yeah.
All right, Ollie, are you ready to take Mr. Mint through the dad lightning round?
Yeah. Get ready. Hang on. Here we go. It's the dad lightning round, Arnold. Number one, parenting advice in 5 words or less.
Sleep. Hydrate. Communicate. Sleep, hydrate, communicate. Stretch.
Stretch? I like
stretch.
That.
Stretch.
I like
self-care,
that.
Right? Stretch.
Yeah, I like that. That's four.
Yeah. That's enough. I'm giving you four.
Yeah. No, stretch is, I like that one. Because Lord knows, as we get older, that one little crick, I got one right now on my elbow. It's not fun.
Yeah.
Pick a superpower, x-ray vision or super speed?
Super speed.
All right. Ultimate dad snack.
Ultimate dad snack. A gin martini with a lemon twist.
That's a good answer. That is a very, very good answer. And I'll tell you why. Because your kid is two, right? I remember when my wife and I would go out for a quick drink. And I discovered my taste for whiskey and IPA. Because you never know when the party's going to end. And you want to get it done quick.
Get it.
So I'm with you right there.
So we have a couple restaurants. I live in this very like budding neighborhood, like Soho House is down the street. Pasties just opened in Nashville, and I can walk to one of my favorite like homemade pasta places. And if I have a window between getting her home to getting her bathed, it's with the nanny. It's like I can walk down two blocks and get my gin martini and get back to be like, we got this. Let's go. Well, peace out. So
you're selling me on Nashville right now. Favorite book to read your daughter?
Oh my gosh. Right now, what are we doing? Ooh, I don't even know the name of the book. It's an alphabet book. It's called Eating the Alphabet, or Eat the Alphabet. Do you know it? It's like A is not for apple. A is for,
yes,
like,
yes, yes, we have
asparagus, aubergine. The artwork is amazing. Yeah. Like, K is for kumquat.
That is one of the books that my kids have aged out of, but I won't get rid of.
It's, I gift this book to people. It's called, it's a beautiful book. I was in my mind, I'm like, I could make this into wallpaper or like get images of it. I mean, the
K is for kumquat.
That K is for kumquat. Yeah, it's an alphabet book.
Now this is going to be a heck of a question for you. Best Thai dish of all time.
Oh my God.
I know.
That's a horrible question to ask me.
I know. I mean, it's well.
And I just came from a Thai festival this weekend where I was asked this question all day long for 10 hours in the Q&As. So, best Thai dish of all time.
I you know what? I have an answer too, so I'm really interested. And it's, you know, it's also
best Thai dish of all time. Yen tha pho is a pink fermented tofu red noodle soup.
Whoa.
That tastes sour like a tom yum with homemade flat rice noodles that are rolled, or big fat rice noodles with seafood, like fish balls and squid.
Ooh.
As a kid, we call it pink noodle.
Yeah.
But the broth itself is fluorescent pink because of the fermented tofu.
Sick. Okay, okay, that was the right answer.
And it's not in my cookbook because I can't nail it yet. Like, I would, that's the one of the things I was like, do I promote myself now with this book here? Or do I do something? Truthfully, that's one of the dishes. Like, if I saw that dish on a menu, it's on my table.
And it's just, you don't see it often, I assume.
You don't know that it exists for you, like, for those that don't really know. And then those that know. Like, it's one of those dishes, like, whoever dares makes it, it's commendable.
Oh, man. I know this is a lightning round, but I really enjoy this question in particular. So, I would have said, and this is because I got the Kaliyah cookbook, but I've really become enamored with Thai salads. I love lob. Lob was my initial answer, but it's Thai salad. But to your point, it is. It's, you know, like, the way we think of soup and salad in, like, basic old school American food culture is criminal, because no, it can be the star of the table. Exactly. So I loved your answer. Okay, we're moving on. We're back to being lightning. Favorite kids TV show to watch alongside your daughter?
Well, that's different from my daughter's favorite TV show to watch with dad, right? She loves Miss Rachel. And I thank Miss Rachel for getting her where she is. But Coco Lemon, because Coco Lemon's a bit of a badass and goes to a rave and puts on glasses and Henley dances along. Like, just
awesome.
Raging out on the dance floor. So it's like a workout too. So.
Favorite music to cook to?
Well, Alexa, please play children's nursery rhyme music. 50 top nursery rhymes.
I didn't see that
for
coming.
Me personally, right now, that's the reality. Usually, that's what's on all the time when I'm cooking at home at this point. But normally, if I'm not, it's usually something classical.
Ooh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah. Wow. All right. Nashville hot chicken or Memphis ribs?
Memphis ribs.
All right. I guess they really are all that. Funniest sound your daughter makes?
The funniest sound she makes? Mm-hmm. Ooh. Is she funny? Oh, yeah. I love this one. Her response to everything is, wow! Like, very, like... Like, she's an influencer already. Like, it could suck, and she's like, wow!
Oh, my God. Amazing. Amazing. Like an influencer. One word to describe life with Henley right now.
Groovy.
Groovy.
It's like groovy. Like it's just fucking groovy. Like we're just like we're coasting and having a great time.
Greatest TV dad of all time.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Greatest TV dad of all time. Wow. I should have known you were going to ask this question. How far do we go back on this, man? Okay.
How far are we? That's your choice, my friend.
Wow. Ward Cleaver.
Wow. Going for the
Can tradition. I go back that far? Do we know?
It's completely your... Yeah, no, there's no rules.
I would say Ward Cleaver. Because from Leave It to Beaver back in the day.
Well aware.
Because that was an era that I grew up that I remember... I know it's a lightning round, but I grew up watching that with my father and seeing a lot of how Ward was like my father, but nobody like my father was on TV. He kept the house, you know, like he was there and like basically by a couple of simple words popped in and like could solve the world.
Yeah.
All the world issues within the walls.
Don't worry, you're doing great. What makes this a lightning round is editing.
Okay. We'll keep this.
All right. Last one, Arnold. Last one. What is the best part about being a dad?
The best part about being a dad is that I have a little mini me in the works. And that's pretty cool to see that I can share what I've been given and gifted in my life with somebody that, you know, doesn't know what their life has in store yet, but I'm excited to see what that's going to be. Mm.
Bring it home, Ollie.
Arnold Mint, you are the world's greatest dad.
Thank you for being here, Arnold. Thank you for doing
thank
it.
Thank you.
For sharing all your wisdom and just your story.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah,
this is fun.
It's very remarkable. Like the process that allowed you to now, you know, be a dad. And, you know, I didn't know about the ice skating. Like, imagine, like, how did the little tight kid in Nashville grow up, like, freaking, like, you know, getting into ice skating? And, you know, much like a lot of things, TV doesn't hurt sometimes. It fosters interest. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. I did, the only other time I've done a podcast like this was before Henley was born. I did it with a local dad podcast.
Uh-huh. What was your role? Were you expecting?
I was expecting. They brought me on. It's kind of like, give us, again, like I was the only gay guy they knew that was about to have a kid. And they're like, can we bring you on for a different perspective? And at that point, it was like, what was the process like to get to here? And I didn't get to dive into all of this.
Wait, was it dad or alive?
No, it's like the dad podcast or something. It was called Tennessee Dad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the cool thing about, I mean, there's a lot of cool things about doing this, not the least of which we get to just kind of mess around and have fun conversations with each other and fun people. But, you know, we like to say, like, once you're in the club, you're in it for life. And so, and it keeps changing. And so hope maybe you'll come back when she's a little bit older and tell us all the stuff that you were wrong about. And
I mean, I'd love that. But there's a lot of dad stories out there, too. So, like, let them have their moment.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a year or two, you come back. Yeah. Whenever it's good for you. You get a new book. Yeah. No pressure. No rush.
Yeah, no, I'm super stoked about that book. When
Dad,
is it
What's for Dinner?
No, your book.
Your book.
Show us your book.
Yeah.
This is my book. Tie. Look, so this is, that's my parent. Those are my parents.
Oh, wow. Dude.
At the restaurant.
So cool. Your parents were cool. You're right.
Yeah,
you know what's so funny? You said your dad was a hippie, but you also said he was like a professor. He's a lot cooler than I imagine.
Oh, they were full fashion. All my eccentricities are from my parents. Like, literally, they're like, they were styling. They were like out every night. They were grooving. They were just, they were the it couple, you know? Like,
cool.
So, like, always, even when he was teaching, like, I sat in some of his classes. I never could take his classes, like, advanced math. But, like, he'd be in, like, white linen and, like, leather blazers. Sick. And I'm like, dude, you're so sick. Such a pimp.
Yeah.
They were cool.
Arnold Mint.
Oh, yeah. So, anyways, October.
Yes.
October 7th.
Where would you like them to buy? I'm sure you don't care, but, like, what's your preferred vendor? Where should people buy Family Ties?
Yeah, so a big part of this is I love supporting local. So if you can go to a local bookstore and buy from your local, please give them some you know, a little love. Because you love them, they love me back. The bigger vendors don't really report my bestseller opportunities. So if you buy locally, it helps a lot. You go to myfamilytie.com. Every city that I'll be in lists the local bookstore that I'm supporting or working with together. Or you could get it anywhere books are sold. Like it's a global distribution, so you can find it anywhere.
Yeah, and what's your local bookstore, just so we can tag them?
Parnassus Books in Nashville are supporting my Nashville one.
All right, we'll tag them. Arnold Mint, you're the world's greatest dad. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you guys. Thank you so much for having me.